Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by California College of the Arts, offering extension courses focused on design, fine arts, and digital technology. Campuses in Rock Ridge, Oakland, and Potrero Hill in San Francisco. cca.edu/extension.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, diplomacy in the desert. What's at stake when President Obama meets his Chinese counterpart at a summit next week near Palm Springs? Plus, solar power is booming in California, posing a threat to big utilities.
PG&E has never had to compete in 140 years. It doesn't have a sales force. Utilities just can't, you know, raise rates forever now without having to worry about a competitive force.
Also, how a Central Valley school district is getting whacked by federal sequestration budget cuts. And a trove of old sheet music comes to life in Los Angeles, musical Valentines to California.
There's a lot of songs in the collection about cottages, about owning your own home, about this is a place where you can leave behind the Midwest, you can have your own garden in your own cottage and live happily ever after.
It's the California Report. Well, two of the most powerful people in the world will be in California next week, settling in for a two-day summit at Sunnylands, a 200-acre retreat in Rancho Mirage, just east of Palm Springs. President Obama and China's new president Xi Jinping will be there for the first time, sizing each other up and no doubt talking trade, terrorism, North Korea, and maybe issues like climate change and green energy. China and California have long, deep connections. China bought some $22 billion in California products last year, everything from computers to scrap metal. And joining us to talk about the California angle on next week's summit is Sean Randolph, president of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. He's written about economic ties between China and California. Good to have you here.
Hi, Scott.
Well, let's begin with those economic ties. What are some good examples about good examples of ways that California and China are already interconnected?
Well, we've been interconnected for more than 150 years. The first Chinese immigrants to America came through the San Francisco Bay Area, and they're still here. We have the biggest Chinese population in the entire country, and that's reflected in our business ties.
Now, if you go back a few years, 2005, Chinese investors tried to buy Unocal Oil of California. There was a big hue and cry in Congress. It didn't happen. Are there things in California the Chinese might like to invest in or buy?
Absolutely. You know, the Unocal deal was very ill-advised on the Chinese part. They should have known if they had more experience with investing in the U.S., they should never try to buy a U.S. oil company. It's really sensitive.
Kind of sets off some flares.
It certainly sets up yellow flags. But there's a lot of other things that are very open to Chinese investment that we very much welcome. And I think you see a lot of interest now in the Bay Area and, in fact, throughout California in putting our best foot forward to attract that kind of Chinese investment. For example, the governor just got back from China a month ago and announced a major investment by a Chinese company in the redevelopment of a stretch of the Oakland waterfront called Brooklyn Basin, a large mixed-use area, residential that will really revitalize the waterfront area in Oakland. They couldn't find an American investor for that project. The Chinese are coming in.
Why would the Chinese be interested when they couldn't find any Americans?
Despite all the other issues we have in the U.S., we are the most transparent, stable economy anywhere in the world. And if you're a Chinese, and there's a lot of issues in China about where do you put your money that it's secure, it's pretty secure here in California, and they wouldn't have made the investment if they didn't see a good return.
What about high-speed rail? Might the governor be able to get them to put in a billion or two for that?
Well, he's certainly interested in that. We all know that it's a big price tag, and all that money is not going to come from the government, either state or federal. At some point, there will have to be private investors, and there have been conversations, and I'm sure there'll be more conversations about the possible Chinese interest in investing in high-speed rail as well. They have the biggest high-speed rail network in the world. Thousands and thousands of miles. The governor rode that train last month, and I've been on it. It's hard not to be impressed when you get on one of those and you realize how extensive their system already is.
Another issue likely to come up is hacking. There have been reports that the Chinese stole U.S. military secrets by hacking into government computers, defense contractor computers, perhaps. The Chinese deny that, of course. But how big an issue is that for California, for companies here, and Silicon Valley?
Well, it's a real issue. A lot of what we produce here is based on intellectual property. Our products in the tech sector are based on all the capital that comes through the design of these different systems and technologies. And frankly, if somebody hacks into it and steals it, some of that value is lost. And so we're probably more affected by this than any place else in the country, except for maybe L.A., where they got a big entertainment industry and they have other issues.
Final question, what might China want from California?
Well, I think China is looking to California, as it should, as a market. We're very large. We're a wealthy market. We are one of the top trading partners in the world for China, and China is one of the top handful of trading partners for California. It's been rising up every year for the last 10 years, so it's very significant for us. We export a lot of ag. We export technology. We export raw materials. And so I think we're very receptive to doing business and partnering with China. I think they recognize that, and hopefully they'll look to California first.
All right. Sean Randolph, president of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. Thanks very much.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Scott.
And as we mentioned, that summit takes place next week at Sunnylands in Rancho Mirage. The 200-acre resort is the former home of Walter Annenberg, who hosted many a U.S. president in his day. And according to Sunnylands director Janice Lyle, the decor may seem familiar to China's President Xi.
The interior designer was a man named William Haynes, who had a style called Hollywood Regency, which used Chinese porcelain, Chinese cloisonné, Chinese lacquer. So he will feel very honored and comfortable, I believe, when he comes in this house. It very clearly honors the cultural patrimony of China.
President Obama, however, might be more interested in the Sunnylands golf course. Among the highlights, a giant magnolia tree on the seventh hole. It came from a cutting off a tree at the Tennessee home of Andrew Jackson. Among the issues Presidents Obama and Xi might discuss next week, renewable energy. Solar power is booming in California. In fact, we're home to more than half of all rooftop solar projects in the country. But as more Californians generate their own power, it poses a threat to the state's big utilities. As KQED science reporter Lauren Sommer found out, the power companies are planning to buffer themselves from solar shock, and you might just see it in your electric bill.
Say you're an electric utility. You build transmission lines, deliver power to customers. So fundamentally, your business model is based on one moment. When customers like me get their monthly electric bill.
Ooh, that's more than I thought it would be.
So you can imagine why a customer like Chuck Pershing might make utilities nervous.
This is from PG&E. Electric is $4.73. Here's another, which was $5.01.
Chuck and his wife Suzanne live in a four-bedroom house in San Leandro, where they recently retired with their three dachshunds.
Buddy, Dodger. That's little Nell.
The Pershings pay next to nothing to Pacific Gas and Electric because they have solar panels on their roof. On this sunny afternoon, the panels are cranking out power, more than the couple is using at the moment, as Chuck shows me on their electric meter outside.
I come out here just about every day. I walk around the house and look.
Where does the extra power go? Onto PG&E's grid, where it supplies other homes.
You can see where it says received. So PG&E is receiving from us right now 4.32 kilowatts per hour.
PG&E keeps track of this and credits the Pershings on their bill. So while they still have to buy electricity from PG&E at night when there's no sun, it's effectively canceled out by the extra energy they supply to PG&E during the day.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
It's called net energy metering, and it helps solar projects like this one make financial sense.
So it has been a great program so far.
David Rubin works on net metering at PG&E.
It was an appropriate thing to do in order to help the solar market grow. We do, however, have a concern.
Rubin says the program has worked. 85,000 of PG&E customers have gone solar. Under state law, once these homegrown electrons make up 5% of peak demand, utilities don't have to buy them anymore. But the problem, he says, is that solar customers aren't paying their fair share.
Solar customers, in fact, really use the grid more intensively than non-solar customers.
Everyone pays for the grid, all the wires and substations, through the price of electricity. By reducing their bills close to zero, Rubin says solar customers avoid paying for power lines they're still using.
Those costs then become the responsibility of our other customers.
Those other customers have to pick up about $200 million a year in lost electricity sales, according to Rubin, which is why the state's big utilities are bringing the issue to the California Public Utilities Commission, the agency that sets power prices. Utilities want to see net metering change, so solar customers get smaller credits or are charged a fixed monthly fee to support the grid.
The utility anxiety is palpable.
Edward Fenster is co-founder of Sunrun, a residential solar company based in San Francisco. He says the growth of rooftop solar is a fundamental threat to utilities, who, until now, have had a monopoly.
PG&E has never had to compete in 140 years. It doesn't have a sales force. Utilities just can't, you know, raise rates forever now without having to worry about a competitive force.
Fenster agrees that solar customers still need PG&E's grid.
In theory, you should pay something for that. That said, you're also providing a benefit to everybody, which is that you're reducing the need for the utility to invest in transmission and power generation, saving everybody money.
Fenster says rooftop solar makes sense, given California's climate change and renewable energy goals. And net metering is crucial for its continued growth. He only expects to fight more of these battles as solar takes more of the market.
I think this is a 20-year journey for us. But again, you know, I think the populace is very much behind solar. I mean, being on the wrong side of history, you can win battles, but it's very difficult to win wars.
Because California leads in solar, we're on the front lines of that war.
The real concern is that as we move towards higher and higher levels of renewable power on the customer side, we're going to see bigger shortfalls, and the utilities are going to have to raise more revenue.
That's Severin Borenstein, an energy economist at UC Berkeley. And he says there's a catch. As utilities raise electricity prices, it encourages more of their customers to go solar, which means an even bigger shortfall and raising prices again. This quickly becomes what Borenstein calls a death spiral. The Public Utilities Commission is expected to release an analysis of this by the end of the summer. Many believe whatever regulators decide to do, it'll set a precedent, not just for solar customers here, but for the solar industry across the country. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Sommer.
Senior year can be stressful for lots of high school students, and in some ways, being part of a street gang can intensify that stress. In Boyle Heights, a low-income area on the east side of L.A. County, police brutality, gang fights, drug dealing, and poverty are part of the day-to-day life for gang members like Angel Garcia. For our series Graduation Day, reporter Shako Liu tells us Angel is now just realizing his gang involvement could jeopardize his future.
Well, my name is Angel Garcia. I'm 18 years old, and I go to Roosevelt High School.
I go to school with gangsters, criminals, and drug dealers or whatever. You know, like, you're going to be involved eventually because you're going, you're living with them. You know, you see them every day out down the street or whatever.
Angel Garcia hopes to graduate from high school this spring, but because of his involvement with gangs, he keeps getting in trouble with the law. He was arrested for vandalism, gun possession, violating house arrest, and assaulting the police.
I got locked up for like 5 months. There was this time when I got locked up for 5 months, and I was going to school, you know. It just sucks because I was supposed to graduate last year, and I didn't because I was in jail.
A lot of Angel's friends have already dropped out of school.
Me? I didn't. Because I made promises, like, to my mom and to my uncle that I just, you know, I at least want to, like, graduate high school, you know.
As a mother, I'm really worried because all the incidents that have been happening.
That's Angel's mother, Maria Garcia.
It's not that he's looking for trouble. He's trying hard. I know he is. I want the best for him. I believe in him.
For years, Angel fought with his father, and his mother was busy raising Angel's autistic brother.
Many times I said, I think that's when I lost him. And it hurts me because I wasn't there. It hurts me when I see what happened after those years. I wasn't there, and I regret leaving him.
About 3 years ago, Angel met a man who said he could help put him on a different path.
My name is Yosef Sanchez. I am the executive director of Operation Street Kids, the Philanthropy Kids Club. What we do is we teach kids how to excel.
The program offers video production classes to gang members and other at-risk youth. Sanchez knows the pull of the street is strong, especially when tensions are high at home.
Once the kids feel let down by their parents, their heart's broken, they're going to go and listen to who? To their friends, and to the core of gang members. Hey, Holmes, my homie, what does that mean? My house and me and you live together in our hearts.
Sanchez calls Angel 3 times a week and visits his house regularly. He goes to court with Angel, checks in with Angel's probation officer, and is now helping him find a lawyer. Sanchez says he connects with Angel because he has his own stories about gang life and trouble with the police.
They arrested me, put me in the car, and they took me to where the rival gang that I was deeply against. It just dropped me off there.
You know, they still do that. Believe it or not, they still do that.
At home, flowers and balloons fill the house, left over from Maria's birthday. In the dining room, Sanchez sits beside Angel as Maria brings out a stack of her son's awards, years of prizes for his top grades and his writing.
This is the newspaper where they invite us. It was 16 students out of the whole school who were the best. I'm so proud of the work he has done. I tried to save everything for him. Kind of old style, but...
That's great. You know, this young man with the proper resources, without a doubt, man, could be a Harvard material, Yale material. You know, in reality, I mean, he can handle, you know, a university. There's no doubt about it.
Sanchez hopes Angel's troubles won't keep him from graduating.
Right now, I guess to say one of my struggles is, well, catching up with credits, trying to get to school safe, and then trying to go home safe is, you know, it's like a mission.
Recently, Angel got picked up and brought into jail. He's out now but hasn't been to school for several weeks. Missing school, hassled by the police, in and out of jail. He's tired of this lifestyle, but he says he can't leave the gang. And even asking to leave could be fatal.
How are you going to start fresh if this is all you know? If this is what you grew up with doing since a little kid, like, how are you gonna walk away from being a little knucklehead all your life and doing what you do? Like, you know, unless I grow up and unless I move to some other neighborhood. But even then, you know, like, I'm not going to feel happy.
Angel Garcia is under police investigation for gang involvement. If convicted, he could face prison time. For now, his dream of graduation is on hold again. For the California Report, I'm Shaka Liu in Los Angeles.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Next up in our Graduation Day series, a high school senior from Venice Beach who's found his calling as a farmer. California is starting to feel the squeeze of those across-the-board budget cuts, known as sequestration. And the pinch is especially tight in the Central Valley town of Lemoore. The local Naval Air Station and Indian Reservation fall under an elementary school district that, because of its unique population, relies heavily on federal funding. Alice Daniel explains how the district is bracing for more cuts.
The loud commotion between classes at Acres Elementary on the Lemoore Naval Air Base sounds youthful and boisterous like any school. But the handmade welcome home signs on nearby lawns are stark reminders that life here is different. One parent is often gone, deployed overseas, so these kids, especially the older ones, take on a lot of responsibilities.
You should see them walking their little brothers and sisters to school in the morning and make sure they get to breakfast, and then they go pick them up at the after-school program and then take them home. They talk about learning to cook.
Teacher Carla Orozco says she and other educators work hard to keep the students focused and happy. But the district has already lost 20% of its staff due to state cuts. And now there's sequestration.
When these parents are sacrificing what they are, and we feel like we have a duty to help these families, and now we're getting things taken away. It's stressful, and we hate to see where it's going to keep going.
Three of the four schools in Orozco's district serve kids who live on federal or federally managed lands, two on the base, one near a small reservation or rancheria. That means those schools don't get revenue from property taxes. To make up for that, federal funding kicks in about a third of the district's budget. It's called Impact Aid, and now there's less of it.
This particular year, the 12-13 school year, we've lost $350,000. That is huge to this district.
Jack Bogard, an assistant superintendent for Central Union School District, says that's a 5% chunk out of the Impact Aid budget.
And our big concern is next year we hear it may be even more.
Every week, school counselor Penny Miller works at all four schools in the district. Today she's at Acres, where she helps military kids adjust to a new school or a parent being gone. She says one counselor for about 1,900 kids isn't enough.
I would say the need is very high. We could keep a counselor busy at each school site, a full-time counselor at each school site.
But next year, there won't even be one. Miller is being moved to an administrative position, and because of the Impact Aid cuts, there's no money to replace her. Students like 14-year-old Jagger Bull say that's unfortunate because military kids deal with so many changes.
You ask, you know, you're talking to someone about their home life or what they do at home, and it's changing always because of their mother or father's military schedule and whether they're home or not.
If you look to the south of us, we have the Indian Gaming Casino, the Palace, as well as the Indian Reservation or Rancheria.
Sitting outside at Central Elementary School, Principal Nancy Davis says students on the Rancheria near Lemoore have their own challenges. When she came here 12 years ago, many of the kids weren't making it past eighth grade. Not surprising, she says, since most of their parents hadn't either.
If we don't have that parental support in that same way of saying, oh, I know what this looks like, I've done this, you can do this, it becomes very difficult to stay in school.
But now the school and the Rancheria both fund an education partnership aimed at keeping these kids from dropping out. It's working well, Davis says, and the casino also gives some money to the district. But it's not enough when deep cuts are made and there's less money for school supplies and field trips, let alone a school counselor. Assistant Superintendent Bogard agrees.
People in our district have not had a raise in 5 years, and they have to teach more kids. We have to plan more. We have to wear more hats. But that's what we have to do, and that's what we do.
Carla Orozco, the teacher at the Naval Air Base, who is also a Teachers Association leader, says she has complained to Washington many times without much response. We reached the district's congressman, David Valadeo. His office released a statement saying Valadeo was against across-the-board cuts. Still, Orozco says, legislators don't seem to have any idea exactly what and who they're cutting. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Lemoore.
The Los Angeles Public Library has a massive collection of sheet music dating back to the mid-19th century. But for the most part, the collection has been stored in boxes. Until now. The work is coming to life with a new book of sheet music out this weekend and a concert series later this summer. As Caitlin Esch reports, modern bands are playing the old songs with a new twist.
In a temperature-controlled storage space, deep within the reference section of the library, stacks of books line shelves floor to ceiling. Librarian Sheila Nash points to a corner where dozens of acid-free boxes sit, stuffed with 50,000 pieces of sheet music.
This is what we call our gray boxes. The popular music when song sheets became small are here, all in alphabetical order, so we call for them all day long, every day.
USC Annenberg professor Josh Kuhn brought his students here nearly every Saturday for a year to dig through this collection and see what they could find. They discovered sheet music that has never been recorded before. They also found sheet music for popular tunes like this one, recorded in 1913, I Love You, California.
I love your redwood forest, love your fields of yellow. And I love your winter rain.
We had tons of ambition and naivete. So we had no idea what we were going to find, like I think all great experiments.
Standing before a spread of music from the late 1800s and early 20th century, Kuhn says they pulled about 100 songs from the collection that tell the history of Los Angeles, songs that were used to promote LA and shape what the city would become. In collaboration with the Library Foundation, they published a book called Songs in the Key of Los Angeles, out this weekend by Angel City Press.
It was clear pretty quickly that to us that, you know, there doesn't exist such a collection anywhere in the country. There are collections of sheet music dedicated specifically to California writ large. That's both Northern and Central and Southern California, but nothing dedicated specifically to LA and Southern California.
Professional musicians have long been coming to the library to search for music to perform, but city librarian John Szabo wants to make the special collections more accessible to the public.
I suspect this collection is not known by the average person here in Los Angeles, and that is one of the big goals of this project, is to let people know that it is here. And it, while it is part of a special collection that's in a special place in the library, it is available for them.
One of the songs in the collection is based on a traditional Mexican folk song called Chapanecas. The lyrics were changed in the 1930s to promote a Mexican restaurant in downtown L.A.
Buenas noches, amigos. Welcome to your favorite café. Café caliente.
It was advertising, basically. You can see here it says, featured by Elenita at Café Caliente on Olvera Street. And there's Elenita with her hands clapping a sombrero over the arch of the, you know, of the restaurant.
Kuhn recruited the LA-based Latin band La Santa Cecilia to record the song because the band got its start performing down the street from the original restaurant.
Swing Chapaneca.
They took the English version, added their own Spanish lyrics, and did it in a mix of rockabilly, punk, and norteño, and completely transformed it.
Then there are songs advertising department stores and even sheet music given away in Sunday supplements of newspapers like the LA Times.
So you see some examples here of a 1901 piece of sheet music. This is a minstrel dialect tune, The Queen of Charcoal Alley. I'm sure the LA Times wishes they had never published, but there it is.
There are many, many songs about sunny Pasadena, golden poppies, sun-kissed cottages, and moonlit beaches.
Come love the moonlight is shining bright. Voices are calling for you tonight.
The LA-based ethnic folk band Petrovich Blasting Company recorded Strolling Neath the California Moon, a so-called landscape valentine from the 1920s, encouraging folks to head west.
There's a lot of songs in the collection about cottages, about owning your own home, about this is a place where you can leave behind the East, leave behind the Midwest, you can have your own garden in your own cottage, and live happily ever after.
Come let us stroll where it's all serene.
LA Public Library plans to celebrate the new collection with a series of free live concerts and events throughout the summer. For the California Report, I'm Caitlin Esch.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. This week we say goodbye and good luck to our interns, Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Craig Miller, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California, and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health Happens in Schools, at calendow.org.